Welcome to Modern Church History. I'm Teresa Holman, and with me is Father Michael Witt. Welcome, Father.
Thank you, Teresa.
It's good to have you here and to do another show today. This week we're talking about...
We're going to be talking about the triumph of communism in the eastern part of Europe after the Second World War. We need to talk a little bit about the French also after the Second World War.
Okay.
And what was going on there. Slightly different than the recovery, the incredible recovery that took place in Germany. We talked about that in our last episode, and we were talking about the what the Germans refer to as the Wirtschaftswunder, the business miracle. Business wonder, that they were able to, the economic wonder, that they were able to pull this off as much as they did. Of course, they did this, honestly, through... American help. It was
right.
It was the Marshall Plan, gave them the money to do that, and also the United States, British, and French armies that protected them during that period of time so that they could concentrate on rebuilding their country, this time on democratic principles.
Right.
And we said that that basically there were two major parties, political parties, with very different philosophies in Germany. One of those, the Christian Democrats, which is the modern equivalent of the old Center Party that had developed out of the Catholic opposition to Bismarck way back in the century before, and had now become the driving force under Konrad Adenauer, very closely allied to the Western powers, especially the United States, very much set for democracy and for free market. That was their position. And the other is the SPD, the Social Democrats, and their position tends to be more toward the left, government manipulation of economy and more government in the sphere, and tend to be a little bit more independent. I think we left off by mentioning that democracy had come to Germany, and we knew it had come to Germany successfully in 1969 when the Christian Democrats, who had ruled Germany since 1945-47, relinquished control and turned over the government to the Social Democrats when Willy Brandt won the election. That was going to be a big change in the way Germans went about doing their political business and business, but that's part of democracy.
Right.
And so later on, the Christian Democrats came back, and it goes back and forth between those two parties. France is a little bit more complex because we always come back to that two nations of France, and that's a reality even in 1944. In June of 19—this stuff happens very rapidly. In June of 1944, of course, you have the Allied invasion of France, ultimately the liberation of Paris, and the Western Allies were incredibly generous to the French in having the Free French Forces actually be the spearhead into the city of Paris itself. Mm-hmm. The fall of Paris, and then ultimately all of France. By December of 1944, as you go into 1945, most of France has been liberated. It's still up in the air. Remember that the Battle of the Bulge is taking place around that same time. But nonetheless, very rapidly, France put together its political act once again. And if we just look at the spectrum, on the right, white France is a combination of things. The old, what's left over of Marshal Pétain, although he's terribly discredited, he had gone over to he was what put together some kind of a provisional French government after the French were defeated in 1940. That meant he had to sign treaties with Adolf Hitler. And so he and his government, the Vichy government, are considered to be collaborators. Also on the right there would also be the old combination of the Catholic Church, the rural provinces, and then old wealth. You also had another, as you move along the spectrum from right to left, the other party that is important at this time is called the Radical Socialist Party. It's kind of funny because they were not radical, not socialist, and they were barely a party. This is mainly made up of liberal class, liberal middle class, and with business interest. And they do have a stellar representative, a man by the name of Mendes France, and he's a pretty powerful politician. But they're not going to end up ruling anything. And then as you go further to the left, there's another party called the MRP, which stood for the Popular Republican Movement. And this is an interesting combination. This would have made Félicité Lamennais very happy. This is a combination of socialists and Catholics. So inside of France now, after 1944, you basically can't talk about the Catholic Church being red or white.
Okay.
There are elements of both.
Okay.
You know, conservative Catholics tended to be rural and tended to be, provincial, you know, in the provinces. Liberal Catholics tend to be more urban. And we're going to see an experiment that's done. In fact, Angelo Roncalli gets involved in this because he becomes the papal nuncio around the same time in France. But it's called the Worker Priest Movement. And this really comes out of that MRP party and what they were trying to do. Their representative is an old line socialist politician that predates the Second World War. His name is Leon Blum. And then finally, if you get to the far right side, the far left side, you have the Communist Party. And the Communist Party of France is very powerful. In fact, in the first election, they will actually take they'll have the largest number of seats in Parliament.
Wow.
The Communists do. They are highly respected. They've got lots of prestige because they were very involved in the resistance against the Nazis. And also they're representing labor. Even more so than the other liberal and left wing movements. And then you've got the most important individual in all of France who cannot be quantified and qualified, and that's Charles de Gaulle.
Mm-hmm.
This fellow is an army officer. He's bigger than life. He really is bigger than life. He stands about, I guess, about 6'5", 6'6". And he makes a name for himself mainly because he rallied the Free French over in Britain after the fall of Dunkirk. The other thing that's important about him is that in 1940, when the Germans invaded, he is the only French general who stood and fought. And not only that, but won. He was a tank commander. And unlike all the other tank commanders in France, he used his tanks like the Germans used their tanks. In a blitzkrieg form.
Mm-hmm.
And he was the only one that had any success. Of course, it was still overwhelmed, but nonetheless, great pride. But he's above politics. He doesn't fit into the left or the right. And so in that sense, everybody kind of looks to him. And right after, as soon as Paris fell to the Allies, he was the man who was going to put together the provisional government. And people would rally around him. If he has any position at all, his position, and we'll see this develop over the years, is a balance of power in the world. He very rapidly recognizes that post-Second World War, the world was going to be bipolar.
Mm-hmm.
We've already seen that, Winston Churchill and Pope Pius XII realized that even before the war came to an end. He also realizes it, but he takes a different spin on it. And his spin is that between the madmen in the West, in the United States, throwing A-bombs around, and the madmen in the East, who are in charge of the Red Army and the Mongol horde, that civilization rests upon one nation alone and one man leading that nation, La France.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and so he's not going to align himself too closely with either group. He is going to be the voice of reason in the world that's going to save civilization.
Mm-hmm.
Anyhow, the elections of 1944 follow. I mentioned that they go heavily to the left, and he finds himself with difficulties with the ministers. We'll talk a little bit more about this in a couple minutes, because I really want to look at Bishop Roncalli in France and in the few years that he was there, the impact that he had. But he had to deal with, de Gaulle had to deal with, these socialists and communists, and it was not always easy to do that. But even in the midst of all the chaos, you do have a couple people who are stepping above and beyond French politics. One of those is Robert Schuman, who establishes begins by integrating the European countries, the Western European countries, together into what he referred to as the European Economic Community. And he brings about, and through good personal relations, an understanding or rapprochement between France and Germany, which is quite extraordinary. Mm-hmm. I mean, they've been fighting wars for centuries, you know, and he brings about this understanding, adds into that also what's called the Benelux countries, Belgium, Netherlands, Luxembourg. And Italy. And they'll form together this European economic community. Great Britain was also invited but refused to join. In 1952, they sign what's called the European Coal and Steel Community Pact, in which they will share resources freely beyond borders, in between borders. And in 1957, then, this is codified into what's called the Common Market. And the man who really spearheads this is another Frenchman, Jean Monnet. And this is the beginning, of course, of the European Union, which we have today. Mm-hmm. And even in the midst, you have foreign policy that is just a mess. The French, after 1944, in 1945, they reestablished themselves, and this is, I think it's the Fourth Republic. It happened so fast, I can't remember. I'm running out of it. Anyway, reestablished themselves as a republic, but they still have this colonial mindset. Mm-hmm. And so after 1945, they attempt to go back in and exert their control. Vietnam is the best example of that. And they'll be unsuccessful. In 1954, they're going to be finally driven out of Vietnam by communists. But they're not alone. Also in Tunisia and Morocco, they were tossed out in both of those. The really contentious issue for them was going to be Algeria.
Oh, yeah.
And the reason why Algeria, first of all, Algeria is relatively close to France, and also the French have had a relationship with Algeria that goes back many generations. Remember, of course, Archbishop Lavigery was very much involved, and many French had moved to Algeria, and they established themselves. They're known as the Colons, and 10% of the population of Algeria was French.
Wow.
That's,
that was a good exodus then, wasn't it?
Yes, it was. Yeah, it was a pretty large number. And these people had been living there three and four generations. So they are as Algerian French as you and I are German Americans.
Right.
You know, and they identified themselves as being that way. But the other 90% of Algeria wanted independence. Mm-hmm. And they kind of did also. And so finally, in 1940, in the middle of the chaos of World War II, they were granted home rule. So Algeria was able to have home rule. But what that basically meant was the 10% of the French Algerians were running everything except foreign policy, which was supposedly coming from Paris. But, of course, nothing was coming from Paris in the middle of the war like that.
Right.
There is an anti-Israeli sentiment. Later on we'll be talking about the establishment of the State of Israel and the reaction throughout the world, but especially in the Middle East. There is a pro-Arab sentiment, and then oil gets involved.
Mm.
In 1955, oil is discovered in Algeria. And you end up with a revolt, moving Algeria toward total independence, and the French army is sent down to Algeria. It is an ugly scene, guerrilla warfare, desert warfare, and there's scandals concerning torture. The French were using all kinds of terrible means of torture to the Algerian prisoners that they had captured. And by 1958, after 3 years, basically the government backed off. And the French government, they were going to withdraw from Algeria and just give it to the Algerians. Well, that, of course, made the colons very upset and very concerned. And also, besides that, the French army, which had been sent to Algeria for 3 years, had been fighting hard down there, and all of a sudden now the rug is going to be pulled out from underneath them, and they were not happy with this. And so a revolt spread out of Algeria. Now, this is so complex. You've got Arab Algerians who are revolting against France.
Mm-hmm.
The French capitulate, and now the French Algerians revolt against France, joined by the French army. So this is chaos.
Definitely.
And so what do you do in chaos? You turn around to the one guy that everybody trusts.
De Gaulle.
And sure enough, in May of 1958, De Gaulle then reestablished the government, set up martial law, and then, you know, he's the one person that the army respects, the colons in Algeria respect. And so he goes to Algeria himself to solve the problem. And ultimately his solution was to grant independence, total independence to Algeria.
Okay.
And basically said to the colons, if you need to come back home, come on back home. Otherwise, you're Algerian from now on.
Mm-hmm.
And he basically sold them out. Whatever attempt there was, and there was some movement within, especially the younger officers within the army, to try to undo De Gaulle. They didn't have any luck at that. Although there's a number of assassinations that take place in France at this time. And what happened is that ultimately the dissidents within the French army were reassigned out of Algeria. They were sent to little tiny posts up in the French Alps.
Mm-hmm.
And that pretty much quelled the rest of all of that.
Well, Father, how many of the French Algerians ended up staying?
You know, I don't know that. But there is a significant number. It's not been easy.
But were they not kind of attacked or whatever by the native Algerians? They were accepted?
Yes.
Since they'd lived there that long?
Yeah, they've been there that long. They're also needed.
Okay.
They're the technicians and the technocrats.
Okay. Okay.
And a number of them, you know, melded into society.
Sure.
You don't have to have a zero-sum game in every event. For instance, in South Africa, after all that, the years and years of apartheid and oppression by a very small white minority over the huge black majority, relative peace took place. Now, the reason for that was that that there are whites and there are whites, and there are blacks and there are blacks. And
everywhere.
That's right. And the reality in South Africa was, which we don't, you know, we don't tend to nuance things real well in the United States, but the reality was that there were Dutch whites and the Boers and British whites. And the descendants of the British wanted to accommodate and work with blacks.
Mm-hmm.
And the same thing was not true with the Dutch. The Dutch resisted it until right to the very end, and then they capitulated. And the same thing is also true with blacks. There are different tribes. And so you had tribes like the very old and very honorable, that ancient tribe of the Zulus, wanted to work with government, and then you had somebody like Nelson Mandela, Archbishop Tutu, who worked toward reconciliation.
Mm-hmm.
And so what could have been a terrible bloodbath, and is in many cases, look at Zimbabwe and the terrible mess that is, did not take place. The other thing too about South Africa is it's very, very rich.
Yes.
And so there was a lot of possibilities and a lot of people throughout the world very interested in investing in South Africa. And so that happened in Algeria. Algeria moved progressively. I mean, it had oil, and it's got location, and it's got a lot of good things. In fact, it's also got a lot of ancient ruins, Roman ruins, Greek and Roman ruins. And so tourism should be a big thing. Algeria is moving along nicely, except for a radical fundamentalist group, an underground group, that still breeds violence. I don't know if you remember a couple years ago, a whole bunch of Carmelites were hacked to death.
Yes.
Do you remember that?
Yes, I do.
That's Algeria.
Okay.
And so it's a mixed bag.
Okay.
You know?
Right.
And, this solved it for the French. I mean, by 1962, they signed a treaty, and 75% of the people of France supported Charles de Gaulle. In doing what a socialist government could not do, he did and got away with it. Yeah. Another thing he did also was, while he was back in power, was he shifted France away from a strong pro-American stand. Now, think about this. In 1944, hundreds of thousands of American soldiers were risking their lives. Millions, actually. Millions of American and British soldiers were risking their lives to free France. And so that's in 1944. In 1966, France withdrew from active participation in the North Atlantic Treaty Organization. And basically, the headquarters for that was in Paris. And we got kicked out. And so the NATO headquarters then was shifted to Brussels. Yeah. And that's all part of de Gaulle's idea of France being the third way, the way of civilization and gloire, you know, glory. Also anti-British. The French become anti-British. Now Britain begins talking about some involvement in the common market, and instead de Gaulle will use all of his influence, and it's considerable. France has a big voice in the EU, and he'll keep Britain out of the common market. And also his other objective, which he failed at, was to get Germany to withdraw, West Germany to withdraw from active participation in NATO. That would have been absolutely disastrous if he had succeeded in that.
Yes.
And lucky for everybody, including himself, he failed to do that. And the third was then to, his policies are anti-American, anti-British, and then thirdly, to build France. And it's one of the reasons why France is now one of the nuclear powers. He developed nuclear energy and the atomic bomb with France. He refused to sign the Test Ban Treaty.
Wow.
Even in the 1960s, when it became perfectly obvious that open air testing was leading to ecological disasters, and certainly Kennedy as well as Khrushchev understood that and signed that treaty. He refused to do that and continued testing nuclear weapons in the air, but of course not in France. he would go to a French colony or an island on the other side of the world.
Oh, my goodness.
And the thing about de Gaulle is that he had incredible staying power. I'm talking about 1966. In 1963, Konrad Adenauer retires. Same year, Kennedy is killed. The same year, Macmillan, the head of the British government, is voted out of office. 1 year later, Nikita Khrushchev is ousted from the Soviet Union, and de Gaulle lives on. Before we jump over to Eastern Europe and look at what's going on over there, let's see some things about Angelo Roncalli.
Okay.
And him in France in the same period of time that we just talked about. He's 63 years old when he got the call. He was in Ankara in Turkey as the papal nuncio, and he was asked to go to Paris to become the papal nuncio there. It was a surprise to everybody, including him. Actually, Pius XII had asked someone else. He was the papal nuncio to Argentina, a very respected elderly bishop, Bishop Fieta, who responded back that he was too ill to leave and begged off. And it was an honorable thing for him to do. And so immediately, Pius XII turned to Roncalli, did not consult anyone else. He just informed people that he was going to ask him to do that. And it became very clear very early on that Pius had been watching Angelo Roncalli. There's all kinds of speculation that the Pope was trying to punish France by sending this no name to them and all kinds of things about snubs and counter-snubs. But the reality is that Pius XII knew that he needed to have a diplomat in France who was going to be able to move through the nuances of this post-war France.
Right.
And he had the man. Angelo Roncalli had a wonderful reputation with the Allies throughout World War II. He clearly helped Jews while he was in Turkey to escape from Nazi-occupied Europe. He had also helped anti-fascist Germans to escape and to rebuild their lives. And so when he met with Pope Pius XII, in one of his, I guess it's in his diary, he mentions that the Pope asked him to use a particular virtue that he saw in him. And the term was a vigor lentitatis. And it's Latin.
Right.
And what it means literally is the strength of gentleness. Vigor lentitatis. And it's what France was going to really need. Remember that when he arrives in Paris on December 30th, 1944. And what struck me when I realized that was the Battle of the Bulge was raging at that very moment. I mean, not too far away from Paris when this massive, epic battle was underway. In Paris itself, Bishop Roncalli discovered that France was ripping at itself, as it always had, the two nations of France. The new government, the socialist government that had come in, although still technically, it was being formed around de Gaulle, but there was a lot of tension over that. The one thing that they wanted was revenge for any of the collaborators. Marshal Pétain was arrested. Now, here's a World War I hero. But he had been president of the Vichy government. He was arrested, had a very quick trial, was found guilty of treason, and condemned to death. In the end, because of his World War I stature as a hero, it was commuted to life in prison.
Wow.
The premier of France, his assistant who ran the day-to-day government, Pierre Laval, once again a highly respected man, was tried, found guilty of treason, and was executed.
Wow.
It's around this time then that Roncalli meets with Cardinal Suchard, the Cardinal Archbishop of Paris, and then also with Charles de Gaulle. He presents his credentials to Charles de Gaulle, and immediately this vigor lenitatis is shown through. De Gaulle is very impressed with him. And not only that, but he was also impressed with the fact that it happened by chance that when Bishop Roncalli was presented to the provisional president, standing next to him happened to be the Soviet ambassador. And, that could have been very tense.
Yeah.
There's not a lot of love lost between the Vatican and Soviet Union at this point. I mean, stuff that had been going on. But Bishop Roncalli, as soon as he came up and found who he was standing next to, immediately turned around with a big smile and shook this man's hand, which absolutely shocked him.
Uh-huh.
But it opened up all kinds of possibilities. And as much as it impressed the Soviet ambassador, it really impressed the president of France.
Okay.
Yeah. But those pleasantries were going to give way to some real thorny issues because immediately placed on his table was the question of what the French government referred to as the collaborator bishops, those bishops who had collaborated with the German occupation. And they gave him a list of 25 bishops in France, and they wanted these guys replaced immediately. They wanted the Pope to demand their resignation. I'm not going to tell you all 25, but two of them included two cardinals. One of those was Cardinal Suchard himself, the Cardinal Archbishop of Paris, and the other was Cardinal Leonhard. And Leonhard is going to be one of the keys cardinals in the Second Vatican Council. And so this was an incredible list. You have to go back and understand that these leaders of the church throughout that occupation period had to walk a very fine line in which they had to protect
their people.
Their people the best they could. Uh-huh. Protect those monasteries, those convents, the churches themselves, the lay people themselves. This was not an easy task to do. And if the government, you know, see, the government now in 1944, 1945 is gloating, especially the communists, who had lost so many people in the resistance, and now they're turning around and they're gloating. They're the ones full of gloire, and so they're throwing brickbats at those who did not go into the underground, and those who found their other ways of doing that. Remember back several programs ago, we talked about the city of Troyes, and how the Christian Brothers had collaborated with the commander who was there in order to help ameliorate problems of he himself being the provincial of the Christian Brothers back over in Germany.
Right.
Those kind of nuances were lost entirely. Well, Roncalli went ahead and began entering into negotiations with the government over this list. And it took quite a while, but by July of 1945, they had come to an agreement that seven bishops would resign. Of the 25, seven of them would resign, that we'd be done quietly without lots of publicity and finger-pointing and that. And he had succeeded in going through and finding, of this list, seven bishops who, either through illness or through age, were about to resign anyway. So it's kind of everyone walks away happy. You know, the government's happy because they got a pound of flesh. And, you know, and the church is happy because these guys are going to resign anyway, and so it's a question of coming up with something new. The French government responded positively by appointing their first ambassador to the Vatican as being none other than Jacques Maritain, you know, the great philosopher and great lover of the church. So that was wonderful. More difficult was the question of the new bishops who were going to replace those seven. And the socialists in the government insisted that they be, and I quote here, outstanding, having had outstanding behavior during the resistance. So only priests who are involved in the resistance should be selected as bishops. That's, of course, very, very difficult. Because most of the priests weren't carrying Kalashnikovs, you know,
right?
In the resistance. Actually, Archbishop Roncalli writes in his diary that the real problem of finding good men to replace these men was this: finding, and I quote here, good and holy bishops dedicated completely to the sanctification of souls beyond any political concern. That's what he's after. That's what true shepherds. He's not concerned about the politics. He's looking after true shepherds. And he said this also. He said, "I leave everyone else the surplus of cunning and so-called diplomatic skills. While I am satisfied with my good nature and simplicity of feeling, word, and manner, the end results always favor those who are faithful to the teaching and example of the Lord." So that's what that's his criteria for suggesting bishops to the Pope Pius. And he needed this in every bit, because in January of 1946, finally de Gaulle had enough with the communists and the socialists in government, and so he resigned in disgust. And he'll go into an internal exile until finally France falls apart and has to, you know, beg him to come back. The socialists went out. They're all excited. The November National Assembly, the Communist Party wins most of the votes. If it wasn't for the fact that in order to prevent them from taking over the government, they didn't have a majority.
Okay.
They did not have a majority. So the socialists and the middle parties joined together in forming a socialist, slightly right of the communist parties to run things. But interestingly enough, after a couple years, the biggest critics of Archbishop Roncalli were not in France. They were in Rome. And the bureaucrats and the Secretary of the State, the Secretariat of State, were very upset with him because he was constantly going around. they talked about him being guilty of absenteeism. There's an old thing called Management by Objectives. It was popular back in the 80s. And there was another book that came out. This is Peter Drucker. There's another book that came out shortly after that called Management by Roaming Around.
Uh-huh.
The idea is that the managers get off their out of their desks, out of their offices, and go around and find out what's going on. That's exactly what Angelo Roncalli was doing. He was doing management by roaming around. Anytime he would go to any mass he was invited to, any church blessing, any inauguration, any conference, any first communion, wherever he was invited, he was. He loved to be with people. And in fact, there were times when he would slip away from the office and just head down to the Seine River and walk along the left bank of the Seine and do shopping in used bookstores.
Uh-huh.
And, you know, so all of a sudden you're walking and you turn around and you bump into this guy who's all dressed up and it's the papal nuncio.
Oh, my gosh.
You know, in a used bookstore. The people loved him for this. They just incredibly did. But it wasn't necessarily that way. In fact, at one point, he actually received a rebuke from the Pope himself. Pius told him, spend more time in your office. In his diary, in response to that, he wrote the following. He said, to go out on pastoral visits pleases the bishops, the priests, and the lay people. They invite me. The service I give to the Holy Father in this way is evident. But His Holiness does not prefer it this way. And then later on added in that same diary, he said, I would rather shed my blood and abandon everything than offend the Holy Father.
Mm-hmm.
And so he curtailed himself a bit, stayed in the office a little bit more, signed papers, and sat around the phone waiting for somebody to call him. It's interesting that before he went to Paris, somebody, a friend of his in the Secretariat of State, had basically told him, get out there with the people,
mm-hmm.
get to know the people, don't worry about hanging around the office and making phone calls back here. He said, because quite honestly, nobody will listen to you anyway.
Right. True.
There are several initiatives, important initiatives, that he was involved in. While he was there, for one thing, he discovered that in 1947 that the French had not yet released the German POWs.
Oh, my gosh.
In 1947, there were 260,000 German ex-soldiers still in POW camps.
Oh, my gosh.
And even more than that, they discovered that, remember that there was universal conscription in Germany. Everybody, every young man was drafted.
Right.
Well, including seminarians, among that number, he identified 500 seminarians.
Oh, my gosh.
And so through his own personal negotiations, he was able to convince the French government to transfer all 500 seminarians to one POW camp near Chartres. And there they established a seminary so these guys could continue their theological studies. When they returned back to Germany,
he made
frequent trips to the POW camps, constantly keeping the French government nervous and keeping the publicity up. But interestingly enough, as his visits to the camps made him incredibly popular with the German soldiers, you can imagine, but also, once again, that strength of gentleness, he also was very, very popular with the jailkeepers.
Mm-hmm.
With the French soldiers who were in charge of that. And that really did a lot in those POW camps to reconcile the German and French soldiers. So they both sides began feeling that they were caught up in something bigger than themselves and didn't blame each other, which did an awful lot toward the binding of human relations.
Yeah.
Another issue that came up, too, was the funding of schools in France. The socialist government wanted to fund the schools on a floating scale so that what we would call public schools, the state schools, received more money than the other schools, which were called les écoles libres, the free schools. And the free schools included, of course, Catholic schools. Now, we don't have this nuance here in the United States because we have a total separation of church and state, and we could go on and on about the justice of that. But in Europe, they do have a sense of responsibility to educate all the children. And so the states support Catholic education in Europe. But what the socialist government was trying to do was to underfund the Catholic and private schools and force the families to pay the difference. And he was very instrumental in that. In 1951, a law was passed in the French National Assembly that equalized those relations. And then I mentioned also the worker-priest experiment. That started in 1943. And it's mainly made up of priests, young priests for the most part, who had very much involved with the concepts of lamine and being one with the people. They had a radical interpretation of rerum novarum. And so these are priests who left their parishes and left their jobs as priests and went in to work in factories and just take regular factory jobs. And what happened very rapidly was within 9 years, it was perfectly obvious that that instead of them Christianizing the workers had radicalized the priests. Again, he writes in his diary and says, the worker priests appear more than ever to be in contrast with the priestly spirit. And so he was instrumental in bringing that movement to an end. And you know, a number of those priests ended up leaving the priesthood and becoming radical leaders within the Socialist Party. But, you know, somewhere along the line, they had to make a decision about their vocation. Mm-hmm. And so he kind of brought that to a head. He was also concerned about the quality of seminary formation. That was his next interest. 1951 and 1952 began turning his interest toward the spiritual and academic formation in French seminaries. And before he had an opportunity to do anything on that, he had launched a study, but that was about it. He was then transferred back to Italy. So that's just a little look into France and into Roncalli. We'll of course be seeing him again down the line. Jumping over into the other side of Europe. When we start looking at the East and what eventually becomes, you know, known as the Iron Curtain countries, that made famous by Winston Churchill. The fact of the matter is that there was just not a lot of information available in the West about the East, mm-hmm. At least until 1957, with the death of Stalin. We did not know. Anywhere near, had no idea the amount of destruction that had happened in the East. All we knew was the Western experience, and we knew that the West was coming back together again very rapidly, probably to everybody's surprise. But for Germany to come back so well, France to come back, Italy returning to prosperity. In the East, it's very different. It's only in 1957 that we realized that 20 million people had been killed in the Soviet Union.
That's when we discovered that, around 57, after Stalin died.
Yeah. The reason for that, Stalin did not want us to know the extent of the devastation in the East for fear that we would have just gone marching right through. And there's a lot of truth to that. The fact mm-hmm. of the matter is we looked at the Red Army as being very powerful, mm-hmm. which it was, and we assumed that there was a huge, powerful nation behind it, which it wasn't.
Right.
And so these are facts that were hidden. 20 million people killed. Along with that, another 25 million homeless. And 500,000 square miles devastated. And this will be industrial.
A half million square miles.
So you're looking at every industrial site, every factory in European Russia, for all practical purposes, destroyed. Fields destroyed. It would be years and years before most of those fields could be even replanted because of the landmines, the unexploded ordnances. So this is just horrible. It's just a mess. And of course, the Soviets have a system, an economic system that is antique and wrongheaded to begin with. So they can't even solve that problem.
You know, I'm just touched by the thought that, you know, how many people were at that point praying in those years, praying, like I think of the Fatima prayer.
Yeah.
Just think if that hadn't been going on, the destruction that might have happened.
Yeah.
Oh, it could have been twice that even.
Yeah, that's right. Well, in fact, think of this. This is World War II.
Mm-hmm.
This is on top of all the purges that had taken place, the Leninist, just the almost genocide. What I think we had said earlier, something like 11 million Russians
mm-hmm.
had died under Lenin.
Right.
You know, and this is on top of all of that. This is on top of what Stalin will do in the future to people, sending them off to the gulags.
It's unfathomable, really. It's numbers that you just can't even perceive. Wow.
His basic policy had three parts to it, and first was to rebuild the Soviet Union. He begins again a whole series of 5-year plans to do this. Managed economy does not work terribly well. And, of course, the communists managed the economy so much so that this is just, it's not going to take place, not properly. The second thing was to secure Eastern Europe as a buffer, to push Eastern Europe as far west as possible. What that means, then, is not only are the Soviet Union, the people of the Soviet Union are going to suffer, but he's going to extend that suffering into Eastern Europe, to all the other smaller states that are there. And then if that's not enough, the third goal, which is actually put on the back burner for several years, it's not a big one, but it will be, is to extend international communism, help bring the misery to the rest of the world.
Mm-hmm.
To build this new Russia, and this time around to make it impermeable, he believed that what he had to do was rebuild industry, but very far east, as far east as possible. There's a mountain range. It's not a huge mountain range. It's sort of like the Ozarks, but it extends pretty long. It's called the Urals, and it's about 50, 100 miles or so east of Moscow. And what he did was he built a whole series of cities east of the Urals so that it would be out of the range of another attack. I mean, you know, think of it from a Russian point of view. You know, they've been pummeled from the West a bunch of times. There's no reason why Stalin would have thought that it wouldn't happen again.
Mm-hmm.
Hitler in 1941, the World War I, the Germans, also Napoleon 1812, the Swedish back at the time of Peter the Great. The West constantly been invading Russia, and so he's going to try to make it more invulnerable by placing all these cities, and these are all very organized, very centralized cities, each about 400,000 to 500,000 in size, from on the east side of the Ural Mountains all the way down to a huge, huge lake called Lake Baikal in central Russia. Now, to do that, he goes through Eastern Europe and literally strips anything of any worth from the old Germany that the Red Army had control of, through Poland, anything that was left in Western Russia, and all of this was moved to the east. He has a real problem also because he's going to maintain a huge army. He has to have a huge army of occupation to do this. The Red Army is going to gobble up lots of manpower. And so they then turn to woman power to keep the industry going and rebuild. And so in a lot of areas, the role of women is very significant. For instance, in the Soviet Union by the 1950s, 1960s, 80% of the doctors in the Soviet Union were women, 80%. And so they play a very, very important role. And at the same time, there's always a constant social unrest. Because while everybody's out there working, nobody's getting the fruits of their labor.
Mm-hmm.
You know, there is more and more interest in consumer goods. It's just not going to happen. If you remember the great kitchen debate between Khrushchev and Richard Nixon, the Soviets had a fair in Moscow one year, and the United States entry into this fair was a typical American kitchen.
Okay.
And it had all the, you know, 1950s. It had all the gadgets and, you know, the toasters and the ovens and the indoor water and all these kind of things that, you know, garbage disposal and all this. And anyway, the two of them got into this big debate over which side was more successful. And Khrushchev's answer was, he said, well, yeah, you can build better toasters and all, but we build better missiles and bombs. And Nixon's response was, wouldn't the world be safer with toasters rather than missiles and bombs? And that was the end of that debate, you know. But it just tells something about the paranoia mm-hmm. that the Soviets had, and they certainly got it from the penultimate paranoic in history, which is Stalin.
Stalin's,
you know?
Yeah.
Yeah. At the same time, he's also cynical enough to remember the importance of Russian nationalism, which has saved his skin during the Second World War. And so he reestablishes the Russian Orthodox Church, but does it as a department within, and that's nothing new, by the way. The Tsars had always had a lot of control over the church in Russia. He does the same thing, even as much as the party, which absolutely dominates the Soviet Union, the Communist Party, is officially atheistic. They have a constitution which allows for the free expression of religion, and then the free expression of religion is coordinated and controlled by the government.
Mm-hmm.
Well, there you have it. Also, he attempts to, I guess you could call it, Russify the minorities.
To what? Say it again.
Russify.
Okay.
Yeah, there are a lot of, I mean, Russia is a nation of minorities. The largest minority in Russia is called the White Russians, and they're basically European, Russian stock. But a lot of the others are forced then to learn Russian as a language, are forbidden to speak their own languages, other cultural things, not the language, the songs, the foods, the dress, all those sorts of things are then suppressed, and everyone is he tries to get everybody in line. And then finally, it's a rewriting of history also, and it really is a 1984 kind of a society that Stalin will establish in the Soviet Union. We'll also spread that to Eastern Europe.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Well, I think when we come back, we're going to take a look at his success at controlling the three giants of the Soviet Union: the army, the Communist Party, and the Russian bureaucracy, and how he manipulates that, and then extends his control over the rest of Eastern Europe, and really establishes, in a sense, then a Russian nuclear empire.
All right. Doesn't look good ahead, does it?
No. Well, I tell you, history's tough. Isn't
it is. It is.
Not always smile face, happy stuff.
No. If we can keep talking about it, maybe we can do something about it.
That's the whole idea.
Right.
Yeah.
All right, Father, thank you so much. Can we close with a prayer and your blessing?
Glory be to the Father, to the Son, and to the Holy Spirit. So it was
in the beginning, is now, and ever shall be. World without end. Amen.
May Almighty God bless you in the name of the Father, and of the Son, and of the Holy Spirit.
Amen.